I'm sitting here in St. Louis. I'm about to talk to Tyler Koepner there in Toronto. And of course, that means we are going to discuss the biggest game of them all, Vanderbilt versus Mizzou. All right, here we go. Who you got?
That's right.
He says showing off his Vanderbilt. So M-I-Z?
We got, I don't know, man. We got the, isn't game day on campus in Nashville this week? So
it is, yeah.
We could intimidate you with a force of our fervor down there on campus. I don't know. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty crazy to think how the Vanderbilt football is, like, legit this year.
Biggest Mizzou-Vanderbilt game of all time. So how about we plunge into the World Series?
All right, let's go.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week by a senior writer at The Athletic, longtime New York Times baseball writer Tyler Koepner, who is set up in Toronto after a month of covering the postseason. You were effectively the Mariners beat writer, right? It was like back being on the beat you used to have. Is that right, Tyler?
Yeah, it was great because we don't cover the Mariners every day, unfortunately. So, you know, but they were one of the big participants in October. So I got to go out there and follow them around every day for 3 weeks. It was great. You know, it's what my favorite city, I think, favorite city to visit, and fun team and good people to be around. So it was a good ride. You know, they took the both series to the limit. So that was kind of cool. Game 5 and Game 7. So that was great.
What is in store? You got to cover then a Game 7 in Toronto. Remarkable game, a great baseball game. George Springer wins it with an incredible home run. Yet another in the amazing home runs of October in Toronto Blue Jays history. So what is in store for the Dodgers as they go in there? I think everybody knows what the Dodgers bring, but is there a sense of they don't know what they're getting into in that ballpark?
Well, I mean, you know, the visiting team can win up here. Seattle won games 1 and 2 of the ALCS. But they do have an offense that's going to surprise the Dodgers. Or, I mean, it's going to be, I don't know if surprise is the right word, but it's going to challenge them because they hit, they get a lot of hits. They don't strike out. And they really, at least in the Seattle series, are really hitting that ball, you know, with authority, just stinging it all over the place. So, you know, when they weren't doing that, they were just tapping it and touching it and putting the ball in play and seeing what happens. So it's a chaotic offense to pitch against. And, you know, it's going to be tough for the Dodgers because they just don't have a lot of pitchers they trust right now. They're going to need their starters to go deep as they did against Milwaukee. But I guess the good thing is that, you know, for a team that doesn't strike out a lot, you know, they'll put the ball in play, so they'll, in theory, not run up big pitch counts, and the good pitchers can stay in the game longer because, you know, they just don't have much depth beyond the starters. They even had to take Vesia off the roster for a personal issue. So it's, you know, there's not a lot in that circle of trust for Dave Roberts.
I like that contrast of these two teams. You have the team that puts the ball in play the most. It has like the highest contact rate. And then you have the pitching staff that went at its best. And, you know, you're right. There's not a whole lot there for, I mean, there's enough, but not a whole complement of pitchers for him to trust that has the highest strikeout rate. When Toronto came to town to play the Cardinals were like, what do we do with this? You know, we're a high contact rate pitching staff. They're the highest contact rate offense. This is not going to go well. And newsflash, it did not go well. But I like that contrast. I find it really interesting with, like, all right, how many bats does Snell miss for a lineup that really specializes in not having many pitches miss bats?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I guess you're set up well for that with Snell and Yamamoto and Glasnow and Ohtani.
Right.
You know, you couldn't ask for a much better staff to go up a rotation to go up against this lineup. But it's a really deep lineup. I think that I know the Mariners were surprised at how productive the bottom of that order was too. And now they get to add Bo Bichette back up toward the top. He's on the roster. They announced the morning of game one. So so you've got Springer and Vlad Guerrero and Bichette, all the big stars. And then the bottom though, the guys Barger and Clement and kind of Falefa and Jimenez, they were great in the LCS. They hit that combo hit 292. So if you can get production like that from the bottom of the order and the stars do what they do, it's going to be really hard for the Dodgers.
Jimenez was a huge part of why they rallied in that series against the Mariners. I mean, definitely. His little spark plug, to get the lineup back around. I mean, he doesn't produce. How many times does Toronto kind of stall out before it can get back to Vlad Guerrero? I found that was a really fascinating part of that ALCS.
Yeah, he did a nice job. He had a couple of home runs out in Seattle. Mm-hmm. In the winning rally, they got it was a walk and it was a single by Kiner Falefa up the middle, and Jimenez bunted the runners over, and then Springer went deep against Bizardo. So they were key in giving those big guys at the top some people to drive in. Although I think Vladdy only had the three solo homers for his RBIs, but Nathan Lucas has done a good job up there at the top of the order too. So they're right, very tough. Point.
Yeah, Lucas kind of gets forgotten a little bit, but he has such a prominent spot in that lineup. Or maybe I just speak that from when you think about like the Toronto lineup, I'm not sure how far you would get before you'd name Lucas, but there he is at the top of it, which stands out. Among the things you've done is you wrote the book, The Grandest Stage, which is the history of the World Series, and it's a great book. And it covers the first 117 years of the World Series, if I remember correctly. And here we are in the 121st, which means that your book covers the last time a team won a back-to-back championship, and the Yankees did. I kind of had to look twice there, Tyler. I was like, has it really been since the Big Red Machine that a National League team has won back-to-back titles? And it has. I mean, it's been our lifetime, really, that we haven't seen a National League team win back-to-back. I got to wondering about why it's happened so rarely in the National League, and of course the answer is the Yankees. That's why. But what do you where would a back-to-back title put these Dodgers?
Well, it would really make a big mark historically, because they already won in 20, and they've had some other really strong seasons. I mean, they're an immovable force right now, in the National League, and they've. It was striking when I looked at Don Mattingly, the Blue Jays coach, who's in his first World Series now, in his 36th year in uniform, and I was looking at his years with the Dodgers, and he got there in 08, and they won the division, and they got the LCS, and then they got the LCS again in 09. And then when he was manager, they had, three first place finishes in his 5 years. And then they've been first place every single year since, except for the 1 year when they won 106 games and finished second and then beat the first place Giants in the playoffs anyway. So it's been a run comparable to the Braves run back in the day in the 90s and early 2000s. With one more championship and possibly another coming right up. So it's a very historically significant run they've had here. And a third title would really elevate it for sure. I was going to say the best team in Dodgers history, but they did win three from 59 to 65. Yeah. So that they have had three in a shortish period, before, but this would be the first, I guess, three in 6 years anyway.
You probably could make the case though that it is the best Dodgers team ever, even if they don't win, because they have the greatest player that we've seen in Shohei Ohtani. They have one of the best all-round players who is playing shortstop and not right field for them in Mookie Betts. They have the second best left-handed pitcher in their history, still a part of the team, though not as big a deal. But it's also like a global team. It's like the best talent from around the world which really few teams could ever say in baseball history. I mean, I think when you put those trappings together, does it add to the notion that maybe this is the best Dodgers team of all time?
I don't know. I mean, those Brooklyn Dodger teams were really, really good. They lost a lot of World Series to the Yankees, but they did win one. The Dodger teams of the 60s were, they didn't hit much, but they fielded well and ran well. And obviously they had Koufax and Drysdale and Osteen and Padres. They had some great arms, but you don't think of them as like power teams because it was mainly just, you know, Koufax taking everybody on his back. They had some great teams in the 70s that didn't win and then finally did win in 81, kind of the last hurrah. 88 was a miracle year with Oral Hershiser taking them there and Gibson with the big home run. Then more recently, they've had better regular season records than they do now. But they really have emphasized October, you know, feeling like it was somewhat empty those years when they would have great regular seasons and then flame out early. They kind of had enough of that and decided to just direct everything toward October, which is a little weird because, you know, you get a lot of season where they're not really going all out to win because they know that they're going to win enough to get in the playoffs anyway. And the whole thing is to have Snell and Glasnow and Ohtani and Sasaki at peak strength on October 1st. And that's exactly how it's happened. So credit them, I guess, for scripting it that way and being diligent enough and getting the timing all right. But it is a little bit like, did you really need to have those guys in the injured list the entire, you know, for all that time? I guess it's within the rules, you know, if no one's stopping them. But it does seem like other teams play the full season and the Dodgers know that they're good enough to, it's not even coast really. It's just sort of grind out a bunch of games that they maybe could have coasted to and get enough to get in the playoffs and then be at their best now. But they are.
That's really where I think their budget shows up the most, like their payroll. It's otherworldly. It's big, but their willingness to go out and sign like a pitcher or multiple pitchers that stack up who are going to be there. And this sounds blunt, but it kind of is, as regular season placeholders while the high dollar ones get ready for October. That's just not a formula that other teams have adopted. And it's not a formula at all that a third of the teams can even consider for financial. I mean, you can't stack, you know, 8-figure pitchers on the Cleveland roster, you know, with the intent of them, you know, one being ready for October and the other just kind of getting through. And the Dodgers can just kind of funnel through. They can play the waivers. They can pick up. They can sign. They can move guys. They'll DFA a guy and go, well, we'll just pay out the rest of his salary and make room for this other guy. And it's just, it's a great way to flex their financial might that goes under the radar of the big headline signings that they have.
Right. True. And I think they have to execute it.
So true.
They have to execute it well. And they've done that. For example, and I'm thinking of the Mets because they don't really have like the high end starters maybe, but they did have a lot of attrition in their rotation and they didn't have the quality to backfill. And you're really not talking about like replacing Cy Young winners with Cy Young winners. You're just talking about like in the Dodgers case, it was a lot of Emmett Sheehan and Justin Robleski and Ben Kasparius and Landon Knack and, you know, really like, you know, good AAA young major leaguers. I think of them as kind of like Ryan Pepio, who's like, he's a real good starter for the Rays now. They traded him for Glasnow. Now, does he have Glasnow's high end stuff? No, but you know, if you put Ryan Pepio out there, he's going to, you know, go 12-10 or something like that with a good ERA and do a good job. And I think they have a lot of those kind of guys who are, you know, good major league pitchers who can keep you in games and compete. And like you say, be quality placeholders until October. Whereas like a team like the Mets, which has a huge payroll too, they really sort of fell apart because when their starters went down, they just could not backfill adequately.
I'm going to name drop here and kind of lead into the question he asked. And that is, of course, our friend Jason Stark, who wrote for The Athletic, are the Dodgers ruining baseball? This is a question that I guess Dave Roberts kind of brought on himself, or at least has some self-awareness that is a good question to ask. So I'll ask you, are the Dodgers ruining baseball?
No, I don't think baseball is being ruined at all. I mean, St. Louis, I know the crowds were down a lot this year, but I think for the most part, attendance was up and TV viewership is up and local TV viewership is always strong. And, you know, people invest much more time in baseball than they do in any other sport because of the volume of games and the fact that baseball can sustain that volume of performances. Of content. I think people always underestimate how much content there is in baseball and how much time people consume the game. So I don't think baseball's in trouble. I don't think it's been, you know, on the verge of ruin. I think all that is hyperbolic. But I do think there's a growing imbalance and a some kind of change is needed to make it so that these smaller payroll teams feel like they can do more of what the big market teams do. You know, I think there's always going to be some kind of inequities, but it strikes me like if you're a Pirates fan, the minute you get a Paul Skenes, you know that he's only going to be there for a little while, and then eventually he's going to go to one of these big teams. It's just, it shouldn't really be that way. But on the other hand, it shouldn't be that the Pirates have an owner who just, you know, doesn't spend much and operates the team the way he does. So I don't know. I don't know the answer, but I don't think it's that the Dodgers are ruining baseball. I think it's good to have a really great team, that everybody can point to and try to topple. I mean, you know, when the Yankees were really great, I don't think that was bad for baseball when the Yankees were winning that, you know, three or four World Series there. I think it was greatness, and it's kind of cool to see great, memorable teams. And there always have been, you know, I mean, the Yankees, you know, Yankees won most of their championships way back in the so-called golden era. Right. I don't know how fun that was for all the other teams that weren't winning. So
That's fair. Well, let me maybe reframe the question. Are the Dodgers ruining the National League?
The way I see the Dodgers in the National League now is sort of like in the late 90s, again, when the Yankees were there. I think of how great those Seattle teams were that had Griffey and Edgar Martinez and Randy Johnson, Buehner and A-Rod and all, and they, you know, they never got to the World Series. Why? Because the Yankees were in their way, or Cleveland was in their way. It's kind of like the Michael Jordan years in basketball too, right? Like, man, we, you know, the Jazz and the Sonics and you know, the Knicks and all these teams were really good in that era. Yeah. With the, you know, and Charles Barkley with the Suns and they just never, a lot of these great players never got the ring because one team was so much better. And it just kind of happens, man. Like, it's just, I mean, baseball's been pretty equitable in how it distributes its championships. There's been more different teams have won the championship in baseball than in any other sport in the last however many years. You know, 25 years. So baseball does have a lot of teams have a chance to win, but it can't just be like 30 champions in 30 years. There's always going to be some hard luck teams, and it's just kind of the way it's always been historically when only one team can win.
You trace the history of the World Series in your book, The Grandest Stage, and the success of the Cardinals, one of two teams to actually have a winning record against the Yankees in the World Series, the other being the Marlins of all teams, but they've only faced once. What's that? Oh, in Arizona. Right, Arizona. Yeah, thanks for the correction there. Yeah, that's right. And Arizona. Both those teams have won once. Cardinals and Yankees have kind of butted heads a few more times in October in the World Series. It's a big part of the Cardinals brand is this notion that only the Yankees have more championships than them and no one in the National League does. Do you see it as inevitable at this point that the Dodgers overtake them? The Dodgers are going for their ninth, which would tie them with Boston and be moving into view. And the A's, right, going back to Philadelphia. So they're moving into view. I mean, is that just something inevitable? Is that something Cardinal fans should brace themselves for, is for losing that foothold in history?
That's a great point. Can the Dodgers win, what would it be, three more mm-hmm. before the Cardinals win one more? If they win this one, that's nine. And I'm not saying they will. I kind of think Toronto might. But let's say they win this one, that's nine. And then 10, 11. No, they would need to win four, right, to overtake the Cardinals.
Three after this one. But, yeah. They would need to win four from now. Yeah.
The Dodgers have two in the 50s, two in the 80s, two in the 20s. Now, two in the 50s, two in the 60s, two in the 80s. Two in the 20s. So the Dodgers have eight. Mm-hmm. Man, because they win four before the Cardinals win one. That's asking a lot. Four more is a lot. I mean, it always seems possible, when a team is great and at its peak, but I don't know. I don't know if they can win four before the Cardinals win one. I guess if they win three, then they're tied at 11. The Cardinals are still up top. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I might take the Cardinals in that one because four is a big number, and I don't know that the Cardinals are going to be down all that much longer. I mean, it just we'll see how Chaim Bloom does, and I don't know. I mean, I don't. You know much better than I do, and it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of hope in the immediate future for the Cardinals, but. I don't know. I can't really count them out for too long. I've seen enough World Series in St. Louis to know.
Yeah,
it doesn't usually spend too much time until another one comes around.
The Dodgers do have a head start on that ninth one. So, and I mean, the Cardinals can't be playing for the 12th at least for another year, and it sure looks like a little bit further. So, you know, I'm intrigued. I'm really interested in it, and I feel like it should be more urgent in St. Louis than it is. But I like how you gave that answer that maybe. Maybe I'm a little bit off there. Maybe it is so hard that even when you feel that team is in, I look at it as a side view mirror and you're putting it in the proper perspective of a rear view mirror. You know, I always think like the objects are a little bit closer than they appear. But you give a proper perspective in the sense that like, okay, well, that's a really hard haul. Even with Shohei Ohtani, it's not like they're going to rip off four in a row. It's not.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not that kind of sport. Yeah.
Yeah, stuff happens. There's just too many things that can happen with too many layers of playoffs and too many other teams that are good. Even in a 16-team league back in the day, with no playoffs, it was still like
really
hard to win six. Because really, you're talking six championships from going back to 20, 20, 24. And then we need four more to pass the Cardinals. That's six in one group. I don't know. I mean, because you know Freeman's going to get
Freeman's 44 games. Yeah, it's 44 games at minimum, which is crazy. Yeah,
Freeman and Mookie are going to get older, and are they going to always have this pitching magic? I mean, I don't think that's inevitable. But it's an interesting question, though. The Cardinals are definitely feeling them in their rearview mirror, and it's been a long time since they've had to worry about anything for that National League supremacy.
So basically, the Cardinals are counting on Max Scherzer, the St. Louis kid, holding the Dodgers back. That's what it comes down to. Max Scherzer back in the World Series with his fourth different team, facing a team that he just absolutely loved pitching for. Not at all. But he's against the Dodgers, so he's the one holding it up. I was talking to Max Scherzer, actually, when he won with Texas, and he was telling me the story about going up to Mike Maddux and, like, kind of sidling up next to him and going, yeah, how many of these, you know, have you won? And Mike Maddux said, none. And, like, Scherzer was like, how? Like, he couldn't – he was telling me how it was hard to process that a guy who'd been in the game, had such a recognizable name, had been around forever, had been with good teams, didn't have a World Series ring. And I was thinking of that story shortly before we started talking here when your story about Don Mattingly came up. I think a lot of folks just go, oh, well, he was a Yankee. He was a Dodger. How does he not have a ring? And here it is. You mentioned earlier that 36 years, he's getting close to four. Well, he's got four decades in the majors. And this is his first World Series appearance. And I think you put it really well in your article where you wrote, quote, Mattingly's absence from the World Series is like a clerical error by the baseball gods. For a whole generation of us, I mean, he was the Yankees. Like, he's a Yankees fan's favorite player if you grew up in the 80s. You talk to him, what does this mean to him?
Yeah, I think he's very hesitant to make it too much about himself. You know, he played long enough, and he's coached long enough, and he's just never had any kind of ego to where, you know, to make it about him. He understands it's the players. He didn't want to frame it as like, oh, I came to Toronto to get that elusive ring. He's not that guy. You know, he's a worker. You know, he loves to be around the game. He's one of those superstars. It's not like you got to ask him to, oh, is he going to get there early for early work, or is he going to really grind it out with me? That's his life. That's what he does. That's what he loves. And when it's time to step back, for family reasons, he's also shown that he can do that. That's why he missed out on the 90s Yankees dynasty, because, you know, he could have stuck around, but he wanted to be there for his three boys, and he was, so he never regretted it. And then we went to the Dodgers. You know, he stepped aside, took the Marlins job. It was a little bit closer to home. It was just too far to commute with a new baby with his current wife. So, and now that little boy is 10, and Mattingly's loving having him around and having him old enough to appreciate this. And so that's cool. Really cool. You know, Mattingly doesn't seem like he's 64 years old, but he is. And it is neat. You know, it's more amazing, I think, that he hasn't gotten there with all the, when you think about the high level performance for the team with by far the most World Series, the Yankees, and he wedged his entire career in that exact window between their 1981 and 1996 World Series appearances, all those years in the middle were the Mattingly years. And it's just, you know, then he goes there as a coach and he's there 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007. And those are the four playoff years they had between the 2003 World Series and the 2009 World Series. They didn't make it in 2008. So he somehow found a way to get in both of those little windows, both of those windows, without the World Series for the Yankees. It's just, it's a quirk. It's like I said, it's a clerical error. It's weird. Then he goes to the Dodgers and he leaves and they make five more World Series, you know, under Dave Roberts. So, yeah, it's crazy that way when you think about it, but everybody's happy for him.
Yeah.
And you know, it does mean something deep down. It just, you know what it is? It's something new. It's something that he's never done before. And he's done so much. He's won the MVP. He's been a greatest player in baseball probably for a little while. He's managed in three places. He's coached. Mm-hmm. His son is a general manager. I mean, like, of the Phillies.
That's great. Yeah.
He's got a lot of stuff that he's checked off, but he's never checked off this. So
cool.
You know, yeah. Maybe he'll hit him a little more when he's on the bases, when the baseline's for game one, getting the introduction. But he said it really is great, gratifying to see how many people reached out to him and wishing him well.
I hope he takes the lineup card up at Dodger Stadium so he can get an ovation.
That'd be nice.
You know, like, that'd just walk really up there for, like, game three. It would make sense, right? He takes the thing up there and he gets the ovation. That'd be really cool if they.
And you mentioned Scherzer with the four teams, and that got me thinking. I'm sure it's in the World Series media guy, but how many guys will play for four different teams in the World Series? I mean,
Lonnie Smith
is the one you would think of in St. Louis, because the 80 Phillies, the 82 Cardinals, the 85 Royals, and then the 91 and 92 Braves, who didn't win but got really, really close. So
I think he's it. He's the only one. He and Scherzer.
Lonnie Smith now. And now Scherzer when he pitches. Because I got to go a lot of threes, you know, like Taylor and Eric
and Will Smith.
Right, pitcher.
Yeah, Will Smith could win his sixth consecutive World Series here. It's just not the same Will Smith.
Not the same. It's always going to be a Will Smith, yeah.
Yeah, there's always a Will Smith in the World Series, yeah. I don't have very many autographs. It's just something that, like, obviously we don't do with the credential and don't think to do. And I wasn't a big – I guess I sent out a lot of baseball cards when I was a kid to get autographs, and I have a cherished baseball from the Denver Zephyrs when I was a kid. Nice. But one of the few autographs I do have, I have a ball from Stan Musial. I have a ball given me by the best man at my wedding, signed by Robin Ventura, my favorite player. And I have a ball from Don Mattingly signed, because I grew up a Yankee fan there in the time zone baseball forgot. But he sent it to the press box for me when I was a young baseball writer. I just was starting off. And one of the photographers snapped a photo of me talking to him, and he went up to the photographer and said, "Why did you do that? What's the news? Am I missing something?" And the photographer said, "No, you know, the guy you're talking to, he's starting off on the baseball beat, and he's going to do this a long time. And, you know, he grew up a Yankee fan, and he grew up a fan of yours. And I thought that would be a good photo for him 20, 30 years from now to remember." And later in that series, I got someone came up to the press box and said, this is from the I think he was with the Dodgers. So it was maybe 08, I guess. Maybe it was with the Yankees. It would have been 05. But he said, "This is from the visitors clubhouse." And it was a ball signed by Mattingly, which I thought was like very aware. It was really cool.
I've known you for all those years. You never told me that story. I was there. I'm sure I was there that series. It was the 05 against the Yankees.
Yeah, I don't really tell that story very often. So, yeah, not really like, but yeah, I have it. Musial, Mattingly, and Ventura.
It says a lot about Mattingly, for one thing, that he would be, first, that he would be curious as to why his picture was being taken in a random interview. And then to just take that extra step to send that up without you asking. And I think that's probably why you have it, because you didn't ask for it. You know, you wouldn't ask for it. You know,
I didn't even think of it.
Yeah. You wouldn't say, "Hey, you were my favorite player. You were one didn't of my favorite players."
Didn't even come up. Yeah.
You know, but like that, it's probably much more special that, you know, what it says about him that he would just do that for you. That's cool.
Yeah, it was really cool. All right. Well, two last things then. All right. What does Toronto have to do to win this? What do the Blue Jays have to do to win this championship? Their first since we were in high school.
Yeah, I think they've got to. Well, they've got to hit the way they did against Seattle. Mm-hmm. And I think they've got to have really good pitching out of the bullpen, because I don't think, you know, Schneider does not tend to use his starters really deep in games. And it seemed to me that the bullpen was kind of shaky at certain points against Seattle. But then at other points, especially at the end, they were really nasty. So it's kind of true in every World Series. You can't afford to give away games from your bullpen. You just can't. Mm-hmm. That's the single biggest reason why the Giants won three World Series, is because they won every game that they were supposed to win. They never gave up a game where it was like, "Oh man, they had that and they blew it." Like, so I think they can't afford to give away a game from their pen. So I think they got to hit, and I'm just saying they got to hit and they got to pitch. But I think that middle relief and that kind of sixth, seventh innings are going to be critical, because that tends to be when the starter will come out, and Louis Varland and those kind of guys are going to be, you know, going to be critical. So, yeah, I would say that part of the game because I think Hoffman has been really good.
Yeah,
I would trust him at the back end, but I think it's though that sixth, seventh inning where if they haven't really put the game out of reach or smacked around the starter, the game will be close and they're going to have to rely on those middle guys. So
really fast.
Say that sixth, seventh inning pitching is going to do it.
Yeah. That third time through the top of the Dodgers order, what do they have for it? Right. It's basically that.
Like, yeah.
What do they have to show them? Yeah. That third look, what are you going to give them? Yeah. It's interesting. All right. Well, we began the conversation by talking about an SEC football game and how Mizzou is going to go into Nashville and beat Vanderbilt and how you said it was a given that that was going to happen. That's what I recall you saying. I'd be remiss. No,
I know what black and gold team will win. I just think it would be the homestanding Commodore.
I'd be remiss not to ask you about another SEC event of the past week, and that is Tony Vitello going from Tennessee to the Giants. A remarkable jump, unprecedented, I think is the word everybody used, because that's what it is. Eddie Stanky long ago went from South Alabama to coach or to manage the Rangers, but he had already been a manager in the majors with the Cardinals and White Sox, so not exactly the same thing at all. What do you make of this? What do you think? How is college baseball that I know you pay attention to? You obviously have a juggernaut there at Vandy to pay attention to. What do you make of the Tennessee to San Francisco leap for a St. Louis kid, Tony Vitello?
Yeah, I think this is where you have to trust Buster Posey's instincts. You know, on the one hand, baseball people talk about how, well, it's crazy that he has no big league experience and how's he gonna, you know, how's that gonna translate? But on the other hand, a lot of baseball people talk about how front offices don't have a feel anymore because they didn't play the game or they don't. Well, Buster Posey played the game. He's going to be in the Hall of Fame probably, and he also played the college game. He was a catcher, so he understands pitchers and he understands position players and he understands people, and I can't imagine that with a hire this important that Buster would make it unless he really, really believed that it could work with the modern player. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to trust Posey's instincts on it and just watch it with fascination because it is something new. And that's a team that, you know, for all the recent championships, it does seem somewhat desperate. Like they have been spending a lot of money now chasing a return, trying to figure out a way to stop the Dodger juggernaut. And maybe
for the good of the National League,
for the good of the game, maybe you need to think differently. And this is different. So I give Buster a lot of credit for. Obviously, this is something he believes, and not being scared to go after something he believes in.
That is Tyler Kepner, author of The Grandest Stage, A History of the World Series, a book that you can find pretty much anywhere. Of course, you can get it from an independent bookstore, and it's available at Amazon. He's a senior writer at The Athletic, longtime writer at The New York Times, and he's been joining me here for this conversation from the World Series in Toronto. This has been an annual chat that we've had, sometimes in person, often in person. One time in like a little auxiliary storage room in Houston, if I recall correctly.
That's right. I remember that.
And then amidst the noise of Citi Field another time. So I really enjoy it every year talking with you. I enjoy the chances we get to see each other. I wish I were there to share this World Series with you and try to write it as well as you will and know that I won't. But I like to try every year. So enjoy, man. Have a great time. You know, history in front of you and history at your fingertips. So write like hell, man. It'll be great.
Thanks, brother. This is game number 130 in a row for me. So
amazing. It's awesome. Yeah.
But then I look to my left and Ron Blum's there and he's from the AP. He's done every game since 89. So he's got over a decade ahead of me in his streak. So
he's the Cardinals to your Dodgers.
Yeah, or maybe the Yankees to everybody else's, whatever. But yeah,
that is probably fair.
I hope to catch him someday. Right.
How many, but let's be honest, how many more operas has he covered than you?
You know, it's funny. I saw Ron once God, it was so long ago. It was Dragon Tales. We took our kids to see Dragon Tales on Broadway. Like, and I think he was there, or maybe he had seen it the day before. But I remember, like, yeah. So, whatever he's into opera, I do know that he did go see Dragon Tales with his kids once on.
That's perfect.
On Broadway. So yeah.
Well, enjoy the World Series. You can find all of Tyler's writing about it at The Athletic and in the pages of the New York Times. You can find the best podcast in baseball wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find the constant Cardinals coverage, including an article where I look at Bob Gibson's Game 7 against the Boston Red Sox in 1967 as maybe the most recent two-way dynamo game before Shohei Ohtani came along. That's available at stltoday.com and in the pages of the Post-Dispatch. The best podcast in baseball is brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. Find it wherever you get your podcast. Tyler, thank you so much for joining me. This has been great. Have a good time and travel safe, and I'll see you this winter.
All right. You are welcome. Great talking to you.